I said it right to the seller. I'm like, you've got moldy walls. What do you mean? I was like, I can see the mold right there. You painted over it. There's mold there. You got moisture coming in. Well, we got a little bit of moisture. No, you got a lot of moisture coming into this, you know, this basement unit.
Hello and welcome to Pillars of Wealth Creation, where we talk about creating financial success with a special focus on business and real estate. I'm your host, Todd Dexheimer. Now, let's get to it.
Are you ready to start investing in real estate today, but don't know where to start? Sometimes investing can seem way too complicated, but it actually couldn't be any easier than with homeinvest.com. You know the co-founder and my friend, Nate Armstrong. He appeared on episode 20, and if you haven't heard it, go back and listen to it, episode number 20. Home Invest is a company that allows you to invest in turnkey real estate. Their goal is to build powerful investment tools that make real estate investing accessible to everyone. They have contractors and property managers available for you with the click of your mouse. While other real estate agents can only offer a property, Home Invest brings you a full turnkey package that allows you to diversify your investments, earn passive income, and start building equity in properties. Their simple, intuitive design allows newcomers and experienced investors alike to hit the ground running and to be able to choose the properties when they want and where they want. View easy-to-understand charts and data to allow you to buy in only a few clicks or just a simple phone call. With Home Invest, you'll be building your portfolio as quickly or as slowly as you would like. And right now, Home Invest is giving our listeners, Pillar of Wealth Creation listeners, a free course on how to finally win in real estate investing. So go to homeinvest.com/pillars. That's homeinvest.com/pillars. To claim your free course today. Hello and welcome to Pillars of Wealth Creation. I'm your host, Todd Dexheimer, and with me, as always, on Wednesday is John Stiles with Bridge Realty. John, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Todd. It's a good day to be alive, and the weather is much nicer than before. So, how about yourself?
I think last week we talked about how we had like 15 inches of snow on the ground. And, or just a fresh 15 inches. So now today it's going to be like almost 70 and sunny. So.
Yeah,
can't complain. I think spring may have arrived, so we're good. We're set and loving life, man.
Yeah, we're gonna hold on to it for a while too.
I hope so. At least until like September, you know.
But yeah.
So John, today we're gonna go through a little bit more about you know, that the estimated repairs and kind of what to look out for on you know, apartments or even single family houses, but what to look out for and some differences between different types of buildings. You got anything you want to talk about before we get started?
Yeah, definitely. So we wanted to call your attention to a comment that came in on our Facebook page. This came in from Eli Sunderland. And he says, I'd love to see a video on overcoming the obstacle that is financing when it's your first big deal and it's out of state. He says, I'm under contract on a 62-unit deal in Tennessee, and lenders don't love to lend to out-of-state investors.
Oh, Eli, you just hit the nail on the head. Lenders don't like you because you're out of state, simply. And it's funny, when I first started investing out of state, I didn't think that would be the case. I've never had a problem getting financing before. Quite frankly, I've never been rejected for financing up until I started investing out of state. And I bought a bunch of properties in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and thought, and I bought them cash. And I think I bought three of them all cash, and then renovated them, got a tenant in them, and decided it's time to go get some financing. And I got rejection after rejection after rejection after rejection after rejection from these local banks. I'm going, what is wrong? Is there something wrong with me? Is there something wrong with the properties? What is wrong? And it was just because I was out of state. I mean, over and over, I was out of state, and they didn't like that. So I did finally get some financing. We'll talk about that in a second. And I have since bought quite a few properties. I bought two or three more in Milwaukee. And then I bought several properties in Cincinnati and in Kentucky. And so it is possible to get financing. It's just very, very challenging. So a couple things to help you along, Eli, and anybody else who's interested in this topic. And we probably could spend a whole podcast on it, so we're not going to. So I'm just going to get some quick tips. And then I think maybe we'll revisit this later on too as well. But a couple of things. Get a partner who is local in the area. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a 50-50 partner. They could have a little bit of, you could give them 20 or 15% ownership. That's going to help still a lot. And maybe they only get 5% or 3% of the actual equity. It doesn't matter. You can split. That's the nice thing about, you know, partnerships. You could split the profits however you, set it up. So just because somebody has 50% ownership doesn't mean they get 50% of profits. Just because somebody has 20% ownership doesn't mean they get only 20% of profits. So you can set it up how you want. That might be something that'll be helpful. Now, with that in mind, they may have to, the bank may want them to sign on the loan. So that could be problematic potentially. If it's non-recourse, it might be a little less problematic. If it's full recourse, you're probably going to have to give up quite a bit more for them to be able to sign on the loan. But if it's somebody you trust and know really well, if it's a relative or something like that, maybe you can work that out. So that would be one definitely easy way to help you out. The other way is when you're buying out of state, if you can find a lender that lends in your area where you live and in the state where you're investing in. So maybe it's a regional bank. In Minnesota, we've got like Associated Bank, you know, they've got branches that are in Bremer Bank and TCF and several, they've got branches that are kind of in this region. So they'll have some out of state stuff. They'll also have, your state. So create a relationship with them. You've also got some national lenders, US Bank, Wells Fargo, BMO Harris, to name a few. They may have interest. So what I ended up doing is going to US Bank, and I went to my local US Bank, created a relationship with a banker locally, and we did the deal in Milwaukee. And they're willing to lend in Cincinnati. They're willing to lend really anywhere that they've got a footprint. They'll look at lending. So that's how I got the financing on three of the properties in Milwaukee, was through US Bank. Now the other two properties or three properties that I got financed was through a company called Renovo Capital. They're based out of Chicago. But they lend a portfolio type lending, so they were willing to do it. Now, it was maybe a little bit more expensive, but really not much, and they gave me pretty good terms to go along with the interest rate. So there's other national lenders that are non-traditional, like Renovo Financial. I can't think of the other ones off the top of my head, but there's several of those too. The other thing is to call mortgage brokers that are in that area. And that's what I did in Cincinnati, is I called a mortgage broker. I said, hey, can you get me a loan from a local bank? And that's exactly what happened. I found a local bank that the mortgage broker tied us together with and got me into, the mortgages there. The other thing I did in Cincinnati was seller financing. So if you can do that, that works beautifully too. You don't have to worry about the banks. The last thing I would say on out-of-state investing is if you can purchase properties that are over $1 million in financing. So a Freddie Mac small balance or a Fannie Mae, and these are, you know, commercial apartment buildings. You can get the non-recourse Fannie Freddie, and they'll lend everywhere. Now, with that said, they still want some local presence, so they want to make sure that, you know, why are you in that area? Why, as your property manager, maybe you can tie your property manager to the property and have them as part of the ownership. Maybe you can, you know, you got to do something to have that local presence. So, but there's options out there. It's for sure, Eli, it's going to be a challenge. That's just how it's going to be.
Well, that's a really great answer there, Todd. You've given us lots of options between finding a partner, finding a bank that has a footprint in multiple locations, including your own, where you live, working with a regional bank, working with a national lender, and working with Fannie and Freddie, right?
Yeah.
So depending on the price point of the property. So.
Yeah, and don't give up on the local banks. You're going to get a lot of, if you're doing smaller balance, you know, you're going to get a lot of no's. And here's the thing. Here's what you will find, okay? This seems odd to the regular person who's not done a ton of deals. And even if you've done a ton of deals, but you've done a lot of smaller deals, it just seems odd, but it's true. You will have a lot harder time financing a duplex out of state, unless it's in your own personal name, than you will financing a 30-unit building or a 100-unit building. The larger it gets, the easier the financing will be. And that just seems weird because it's more money, but it's true. A local bank or Fannie Freddie are going to be more excited to finance a 50-unit building or a 100-unit building than they will be a 5-unit building.
All right. Well, very good. Well, let's transition here, Todd, into our topic today. Like you mentioned, we did start this topic. We're on this series of apartment investing where we started the topic of estimating repairs last week. But we had more that we wanted to cover here. So let's talk, for example, about how the age of the building will affect the repair estimate.
Yeah, so, you know, the older the building, the more problems you could potentially have. And there's certain eras that are built better than other eras. So that's something to keep in mind as well. Try to get to know the buildings and as well as you can. And then be talking with, obviously, your local contacts, your contractors and your property inspectors. They're going to know, too, like, you know, you could just ask a property inspector, what do you see most in buildings built in, let's say, 1910 to 1930? And they'll tell you what they see most. What do you see most in buildings that are built in 1950, that are built in 1980, that are built in, you know, 1990? And they'll tell you what they kind of see. What era of buildings do you like the best that are maybe built the best, and they're going to help you out and help you understand, you know, what are the challenges. But one of the challenges for me for these, you know, old buildings, late 1800s, early 1900s built, they're often built poorly without standards. So you might go into one building, like I had an apartment complex that was built in 1888, I believe. And in that apartment complex, the joists were massive. I mean, they were huge, huge joists. I think they were like 18 inches deep. They were a full 2 inches, and some of them were even thicker than that.
You're talking about the floor joists?
The floor joists. Yeah. So the floor joists were really solid, really solid, built really, really well. And the reason I'm saying this is because I also had bought a house, a single family house, not very far from that apartment building. And that house was built in 1896. And those floor joists were really small. They were undersized. They were, you know, it was built structurally very poorly, and I had to redo the structure. I just sister along new joists because literally the floor, and we didn't find out until we started ripping things apart and opening things up. So we opened the ceiling up, started opening the floor up, and we saw that joists were actually cracked in half. So the floor was essentially failing. So that just tells you that there's no standards. You know, one builder might go, we're going to build this thing really strong and right. And then the other builder is just going to go, let's throw these in there. This is what we got. And that was kind of how things were built. And, you know, back in the day when everything was done right, everything wasn't done right. So you've got to watch for things like that. Oftentimes the rafters are way undersized. And you'll see the bowing and the cracked rafters and stuff like that. Foundations are undersized. Foundations are maybe not completely put in right, or beams aren't supported properly. There's footings are missing. You know, all kinds of stuff like that you've got to really look for on these early 1900s era, late 18s. Just lots of structural problems with those buildings, or potential structural problems.
Yeah.
Those buildings. This same building that had the joists, the floor joists that were really, you know, sturdy and stable, it was a brick exterior. Well, what I would say is that from poor installation, they poorly installed the brick, and now the brick was failing on the outside. So just things to look out for. The construction is just not done well.
Yeah, I can give you an example of footings, like you mentioned. Like, I've got a four-unit building where it has the front porch, which has since been turned into a sleeping room.
Yeah.
And that front porch wasn't built on top of the foundation.
Right.
So it's a stucco exterior, and you can tell there's a little bit of cracking and a little bit of settling in that stucco because, you know, it doesn't have the proper support and foundation or a footing in place underneath that sleeping room porch. So,
yep. Yeah, that's going to be almost 100% of the time, John, is when you're buying this old, you know, cool Victorian, you know, 1910, whatever house, and it's got that front porch on it, which is beautiful and awesome. It doesn't have footings, and you're going to have problems with movement, and that's just how it is. And if you got a finished space, that's exactly what's going to happen. That's almost like 100% of the time, it seems like. The other thing that happens too is the grading. So the grading saddles, and they didn't pay attention as much to grading as we do now. So you're going to have grading that goes into the building. So you're going to oftentimes have moisture that goes into the building. If you don't have moisture, you've had years of likely that grading coming down and moisture coming down the walls, and hydraulic pressure is trying to push the walls in, whether it gets into the house or not. Either way, that hydraulic pressure is pushing those walls, forcing them in. You might have some good cracks in those buildings, which you really want to look out for. We'll talk about the cracks and the differences in those, but that's something to really be concerned about. So the grading can be an issue as well. And then the gutters, you know, a lot of them didn't even have gutters until recently, or maybe they still don't even have them. And so that can also cause a lot of hydraulic pressure as well. If we don't have the water going away from the building, we can have problems.
Yep. That is a huge concern in a lot of properties. Just is the basement wet? Is it humid? Is it moist? Mm-hmm. A lot of times that can be fixed with grading. Sometimes it can't be, you know, but most of the time that's one of the main fixes you look towards.
Yeah. And even if it can be fixed, which is great, you want to pay special attention to the foundation and make sure the foundation didn't sustain damage prior to you being able to fix it. So for sure. So then we got, you know, you've got an era, I would say, all the way from the 1800s all the way until like 1940-ish, where these are some of the problems that can happen. Then in the 40s, 50s, and especially the 50s and 60s, and even in through the 70s, you have very well-built houses for the most part. The biggest challenge on those houses is not how well they're built. You do have the grading issues that we already talked about, so you've got to watch out for that. You do have that hydraulic pressure that can happen, and that's in any age house that's really over like 10 years old. You got to watch the grading because grading settles. But what you've got a couple main factors that are challenges on these houses. Is it's built before 1978. It often has lead and asbestos in it, so we need to watch for that. If that lead or asbestos is basically open and potentially peeling or cracking or fraying, then we've got some environmental issues and we've got some potential lawsuits on our hands if we buy this building and we don't take care of those things. If you've got lead, let's say you got those old, you know, beautiful windows and they're opening and closing, but you've got lead anywhere that was painted on the window or painted on the sills or anything that's opening and closing, that's causing dust every time. And that's getting into the little kids' lungs, and that can cause some lead poisoning in those children. And whether they got it from your property or not, they're going to look at you first if your building's built before 1978 and you've got potential issues. So they're going to do some testing and make sure. So, you know, replace those windows with the vinyl replacement style windows and you've got no problems. You've also, you know, watch for peeling and cracking paint. Obviously those are really obvious things. And then watch for, we've got a lot of our boiler lines that were wrapped in asbestos. Watch for that. If it looks like there's insulation on it, likely that's asbestos. Ceiling tiles and floor tiles often have asbestos in them too. So,
and insulation can as well.
Yeah, insulation can, but we're not worried about insulation unless we're doing remodeling because it gets covered. So yes, but you're right. Insulation we should look for if we know we're going to be opening up walls or doing any sort of, yep, you know, ceiling work or anything like that, for sure.
Yeah,
sure. And just know that if you buy a building built before 1978 and you do disturb a lot of the walls, you should be testing them for lead, because if they have lead in them, you need to take care of them properly. The EPA has standards now, and they've had them for going on close to 10 years, where you have to be EPA certified to work on a house that has lead in it. And you are responsible as a contractor or as a homeowner, if you're doing the work yourself, to test it. Now, if you're living in the house, you can do anything you want. The EPA allows you to poison your family, but they don't allow you to poison other people. So if you have tenants that are living there, they don't allow you to poison them. They make you test it. If you get caught not testing it, you can get, I think it's big penalties. It's like, yeah, $50,000 penalty type of thing. So you can get big penalties. So you've got to make sure that's going to cost you a little bit more money to do those remodels then if there is lead, because now you're going to have to get rid of it properly. It's not really abatement, I wouldn't call it. So it's not going to cost you huge amounts of money, but the contractor has to just do things the right way, essentially, and clean up the right way and not cause dust the wrong way.
So. Yeah, that's definitely something to be aware of for those buildings. You know, whether you're redoing the bathroom and rechanging out the sheetrock, you know, a lot of those types of things, you just got to budget a little bit extra than a property that's newer.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the process to properly work in that environment is quite in depth. They have to put, you know, plastic off all the areas to contain the dust. They have to use special HEPA vacuums to clean up any dust. And then you know, all these different things. So,
wow, John, that's impressive. I didn't know you knew all that stuff. That's great. Most people have no clue that you have to do that stuff. So that's awesome that you know that.
Yeah. A couple of years ago, I went through that training.
You did. Awesome.
Yeah. So okay. I was renovating my own building and wanted to make sure I was following the rules. So,
well, good for you, because most people don't pay any attention to that. They just go ahead and do it, and then all of a sudden somebody gets sick, and now you're in big trouble. Yep. So
you don't want to get into it after the words and then have somebody walk in, a city inspector or even a tenant, and something happens.
Yeah.
And then they ask you, where's your reports? Where's your records of the test results?
What records?
Well,
what are you talking about? So the other thing, John, you've got an old fourplex in you were telling me you've done some plumbing work to it. Why? What's the problem?
Yeah, the older buildings have quite an interesting combination of different materials used for the pipes. So a lot of it's galvanized pipe. Then it could be mixed up with some steel. Then it can be mixed up with some, you know, all sorts of different things.
Yeah, with copper, with plastic, copper, lead.
Yeah. So when you have those different materials joining together, you know, a lot of times they fail at the joints. Or just the galvanized pipes, it corrodes and rusts over time, and you'll get little, you know, pinhole leaks or lots of corrosion at the joints. So yeah, when I had my bathrooms in the building renovated, you know, there's a huge stack that goes up the middle. And that was all sitting kind of crooked like this. And, you know, it was just time to update that to the modern PVC. And, so you got to plan for those things.
Yeah, and what happens with both galvanized and cast, like you said, they develop these pinholes. But what also happens, too, is galvanized water has, you know, crud in it. It just has stuff in it. I don't care that it's been filtered and you think your water is completely clear and clean. It's got calcium. That's one of the biggest things that's going to happen. But what it does is as it runs through these lines, it breaks up the galvanized, the calcium builds up. They build up on a lot of the fittings that are there, and they eventually create this little tiny hole that the water goes through. And so you lose that water pressure. So if you're living in an old house and you get that water pressure, you're like, what is going on? It could be just as simple as the filter on your faucet that you just need to unscrew and rinse out. But it could be that your galvanized lines have basically, they're instead of being a half inch in diameter, they're, you know, an eighth inch in diameter, and barely any water can get through them. So that happens, as well as the rotting out. And same thing with your waste pipes. They eventually get clogged, and you've taken apart waste pipes where it's like, it's just this big rust buildup, and you've got this little tiny hole that the water seeps through, and you wonder why you're always getting, backups and clogs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So the other thing in these old buildings is, other than the piping, is going to be your wiring. So a lot of times knob and tube wiring can be in those. So it's really old wiring. Those are obviously problems with fires. You can keep knob and tube and limp it along. Now that we've got these LED bulbs, that'll help a lot. If you put LED bulbs in, that gets the fixtures don't get nearly as hot. So that'll help. But it's just, you know, knob and tube is definitely old and oftentimes really brittle and cracks and causes fires. The other thing you've got is old furnaces, ACs, boilers, boiler lines, all that kind of stuff. Those can cause problems too, just being that, you know, really old. They can cause issues.
Yep. And those old, the old wiring normally wasn't grounded. And so
yep.
You have some people think they can just switch out the outlet to be a three-prong outlet, and then it appears to be grounded.
Yeah.
But it literally isn't, which again can be a fire hazard.
Yep. And sometimes you can fix that easy. If you got a galvanized, if you got a metal box, you can hook the ground wire up to the metal box. And sometimes that's going to ground it depending on how the wiring's run, if it's running conduit and stuff. But other times it's more than that. So yeah, you've got to pay attention. If you're trying to use something that needs to be grounded in a non-grounded outlet that appears to be grounded, well, then like you said, you could have some problems with that. So the 1980s and 1990 buildings, those ones are the interesting ones. I personally don't like those buildings very much. Now the late 90s are typically fine, but like I'm talking like early 90s, they're just built really cheap. And that's in my experience, and that's not always the case, but oftentimes the case. They look nice, but they're just cheap, 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 cheap. And you've got undersized joists, you've got squishy, spongy floors, you've got bold walls, you've got, you know, wavy roofs. They just put in cheap material overall, and they skimped on like everything. And I don't know why, but that was the era of like, let's just put up a bunch of crap and see if people buy it. Because to me, that's what a lot of those houses are. They're just cheap. And I don't know if there just wasn't good code enforcement or what happened during that era, but personally, those houses can look really nice on the outside and just be just cheap. So just pay attention, I guess, to some of the things. You know, a lot of the problem is seeing things, you look at it, oh, that looks nice, but just try to pay as much attention as you can with the building. Does it feel good? Like as you walk, is it weird, kind of like echoey? Are the floors spongy? Do you feel like you're kind of going on this like bumpy floor? When you look at the roof, are there waves everywhere? Look at the walls on the outside, kind of put your eye on them. Do they bow? Do they do funny things? Those properties, you know, if they were built and they put vinyl siding on them, that vinyl back then was just cheap and likely should be replaced. The vinyl now is 300 times better. It's still cheap, but 300 times better. So just, you know, look for things like that if you're going to buy that 1980 to early 1990 product. The good thing with those houses or apartments is they're going to have copper plumbing. They're going to have, it's all going to be set up with newer, more kind of in line with the times mechanicals, you know, your HVAC and your electrical and your plumbing are all going to be kind of set up with newer style. So it's easy to replace a furnace or, you know, something like that.
Yeah. You know, and when, as you're describing all of these deficiencies of these various eras, somebody might get kind of cold feet about, you know, oh, I guess I have to buy brand new. Is that the kind of message you're trying to portray here?
Yeah, absolutely. Buy brand new because brand new is the best. And it is. You know what? Yeah, buy brand new. If you can buy brand new and make the numbers work and it looks, you know, the investment looks solid, buy brand new. I would never tell anybody not to buy brand new because that you're going to get the best product. You're going to have the least amount of headaches. And likely you're going to have the most efficient building. Now we pay a lot of more attention on environmental and efficiencies and stuff like that. And so, yeah, buy brand new. But oftentimes that just doesn't work, right, with the numbers. And we're looking at different era buildings because the numbers work better or that's just what's for sale. And we just got to be aware of the product that we're getting ourselves into. And pay special attention to things that might be problems with that era of a building. Most of my buildings are, I have zero brand new buildings. Most of my buildings are older. And, I'm just aware of the issues that could potentially take place on those buildings, and I budget for them.
Yep. You know, I have a building that, I have a 3-unit building that was built fairly new, 2006. That's younger than I am. But interestingly enough, I've discovered there was some deficiencies with the way they built that property. It seems that they've insulated it so well that the house doesn't breathe very well. And so I've actually got a lot of humidity and moisture issues in my almost new building. Apparently that's been something they've discovered through that time period in the mid 2000s.
Yep.
And, I think they do it much better.
Yep.
So
from the it's really from pretty much 2000, maybe late 90s, but all the way through about 2006-7. Mm-hmm. It's not that they insulated it too well. It's that they sealed it too well.
So right.
Your building envelope doesn't have a chance to breathe, causing moisture trap. And so you can get moisture in between the walls. And if there's moisture in the insulation in our environment, it freezes. And then in the winter, the moisture or the insulation is no good. Because how insulation works is it's air pockets. That's what makes it, you know, good. And so if we eliminate air pockets through ice pockets, that cold air can just transfer right through it. So yeah, that 2000 to 2006 can have problems.
Yeah.
So it's good to know. I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about. Know the issues of the buildings and know the potential holdups that you're going to have. And if you know that, hey, this building might be too tightly, you know, sealed, what can we do? Well, we can put an air exchange, you know, unit in there. Maybe we have to do two of them, one for each floor. But that might be a simple fix. It might cost you, you know, $500 or $1,000 or whatever, but just knowing that we need to budget for that is important.
I'm going to have to get your contact for that because the quotes I'm getting for air exchangers are much more.
Yeah, they're probably more than that. They're probably triple that likely, or maybe even more than that. I don't know. You probably could do it for, if you do it yourself, you could probably do it for pretty cheap if you want to do it yourself. But all right, so let's talk about some things we want to really look for really in every single building. And I've got just a list, and I'm going to make it kind of quick because we're already getting, you know, long here. But some of the things that I think you need to pay special attention to, it's going to be structural issues. That's the number one thing you want to look for. And you want to look for foundational issues, especially. So you want to look for cracks in the foundation. Now, you've got several different types of cracks in your foundation. You've got a long horizontal crack, and that is the one you want to really look for. If you've got a long continuous horizontal crack, you can put like a, you know, a 6-foot level on that or something, a straight edge of some sort, you know, 5, 6, 7 feet tall, and put it up on that wall, and you'll be able to see, does it bow or not? And likely, if you've got that long crack, it's going to be bowing, and that wall could eventually cave in or cause enough structural damage to the house for failure. You've also got the vertical cracks and the stair step cracks, and those are often kind of evidence that maybe if it's in a corner, that a corner is kind of sinking of the building. That can be typically due to water pressure, and same with that horizontal, that can be oftentimes due to water pressure as well. So those cracks need to be addressed. The other cracks are going to be your hairline cracks, and those are likely not going to be anything, especially if you got a couple little vertical cracks, maybe a small horizontal crack. I mean, look at them, definitely don't just ignore them. But if you've got a crack that's over a quarter inch in size, you want to really look at what is happening to that building and what's going on. So those are things to look for. And don't just assume their housing inspector is going to catch these things. Point them out to the housing inspector and go, look at that crack. What do you think about that? And if they say it's nothing, but you're really still a little nervous, then you might want to hire an engineer to look at it or get a second opinion, get a contractor or something like that.
Yep. Yeah, a lot of times those general home inspectors or property inspectors, they're just looking for the overview of the property. And when it gets into specifics, then they say, you know, this is what we think, but you really need to hire a specialist.
Yep. So then other structural issues, you're looking at the outside. You know, you mentioned the stucco on the porch, and you mentioned the cracks in the stucco, and that was telltale sign that the porch doesn't have footings. So looking for stuff like that, looking for cracks in your siding, looking for cracks in your drywall or plaster, looking for floors that are doing crazy things, and looking for the roof line. What does that roof line do? Is the roof line, you know, straight like it should be, or is it kind of go up and down and sideways and every which way? So we want to look for things like that and pay special attention to that as well for structural issues. And then, of course, you know, having your inspector there, but pointing issues out to your inspector is always a good thing. The other thing is look for cover-ups. You know, is the foundation covered in areas where you wouldn't really expect it to be? So you've got maybe a living room area or family room. Sure, that should be covered, but maybe you've got your utility room and the foundation's all covered up there. Well, why? You know, should it be? What's the seller trying to hide? You know, did they recently paint? Like, so I was looking at a building not too long ago, and I could just, it was so obvious. The seller painted a vacant unit that was moldy. It was so obvious that it was moldy. You could see the old mold spores everywhere. And they just painted over it because they wanted to hide it so nobody saw it. But like, my eye is trained to catch things like that. It was just like, I said it right to the seller. I'm like, you've got moldy walls. What do you mean? I said, I can see the mold right there. You painted over it. There's mold there. You got moisture coming in. Well, we got a little bit of moisture. No, you got a lot of moisture coming into this, you know, this basement unit. So it's like, you got to try to look for stuff like that, especially in basement units. You know, what's going on with the drywall? Has it been painted over? Does it look weird? If it looks weird, you know, really dig into it. Carpet, is the carpet wet? Can you just take your hand around the very perimeter and feel, and or take your foot and feel? Is it wet, damp at all? So look for cover-ups, look for, you know, on the ceilings, look for weird patches, stuff like that.
Yeah. And even if the sellers, you know, I tend to try to think the best of people and that they wouldn't intentionally try to cover things up, but nonetheless, they're not going to always point out what's wrong.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. They might be aware of something and just don't ask, don't tell type of thing. You
or
know?
They forgot, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So definitely, you know, use that inspection period to really investigate. And then, you know, when you find the issues, make sure that you're budgeting enough for it.
Yeah. So. Yeah, absolutely. You know, two more things. Pay special attention to the mechanicals. And by mechanicals, I mean your, you know, anything with your plumbing, anything with your HVAC, and then anything with your electrical. And so if they're old, water heaters, 10 to 12 years old, furnaces, 20 to 30 years old, you know, they're likely going to have to get replaced. Plumbing, if the plumbing's, you know, the galvanized or cast iron or lead, like we talked about, it's too old and it's going to need to be replaced. You might be able to limp it along, but eventually all that stuff's going to be replaced. If you've got fuse boxes, those are old. Those need to be replaced. A lot of insurances won't even cover that. If you've got some certain types of panels that no longer manufactured, try to make sure that the electrical panel, that the brand is still being manufactured. If it's not, like Federal Pacific, that's a challenging brand, and the insurance companies balk at it, and they'll charge you a lot more. So simple, just to look up, you know, Is this Square D? Is it still in business? Oh yeah, it's still in business. Roofs, is your roof, 20 to 30 years old? Does it look like it's curling, or, you know, is there problems with it, or is there cracks in it, whatever. Hopefully your inspector can do that, or your roofing contractor can get up there and do that. And the last thing is look for moisture. That's the biggest thing, other than structural, to me, is look for moisture and look for areas that bugs and pests can get into. So little holes anywhere. Look for stuff like that. Can they get into that building somehow? Bees and birds and bats, and squirrels, they can just do major damage to your building. So pay attention to that. You know, if you see a bird flying out of your building, you've got some issues there, right?
Yeah.
It can be a very challenging thing. Squirrels are really hard to get rid of, and they can cause major, major damages. They can cause fires as well. They're insects and rodents are very challenging and can cause major damage. And of course, you've got termites and carpenter ants. Those can cause major, major damage. So just pay attention to that, and hire inspectors is very, very critical, and try to make sure they look at all the building, the whole envelope, everything inside, outside, and all. And it's going to cost you a little bit more money to hire a, exterminator to come out and do a walkthrough of the building and tell you there's no termites. But it's worth it, because if you do have termites, A, you want to take care of it. B, you want to make sure it hasn't gone too far before you buy the building.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Or anything. I do sewer scopes too, because I want to make sure there's no tree roots and stuff like that in my sewers. If there is, I don't want to buy the building, or I want to make sure I budget on that, because that can cost you $10,000 or more just to fix something like that.
Yeah, definitely lots to consider here. And you want to know what to be budgeting if there's an immediate renovation or just long-term.
Yeah.
What are the maintenance things to budget for on a routine basis?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you want to know today, and you want to know tomorrow what you're going to be budgeting for.
Right. Yeah,
for sure. Well, cool. I think that's it. Hire inspectors, hire contractors, get to know the numbers. You're not going to potentially become an expert in all this stuff. That's why we talk about teams and building your team. So make sure you have, if you're not the expert, make sure you have experts in place. And even if you are the expert, make sure you have other people backing you. I mean, I know this stuff very, very well. I'm a licensed contractor. I've been doing this for a lot of years. I know buildings very well, but I still hire contractors, and I still hire inspectors to walk through these properties with me, because it's extremely important. It's so easy to miss stuff, and it's so easy not to remember, oh, we should be checking this, that you're going to get in trouble if you're not hiring the right people. But don't rely on them. That's why I'm talking about this, because I don't want you to solely... I don't want you to have just one person that you're taking their word as the Bible. I don't want that, because that's when you could get in trouble. You need to make sure you have several people. Hire that contractor, go through it yourself, and then also have the inspector. Now you've got three people looking at it, and your property manager. So now you've got four people. And now maybe your broker goes through and looks at some of the units with you. So maybe now you got five different people. Yep. That's really important. The more people you can get in there, more eyes, the more you're going to catch.
Right. Definitely. For all those listeners and viewers out there who maybe have further questions on this particular topic, or another one, just like we answered a question here at the beginning, we invite you to shoot us your questions on Facebook or on YouTube, or you can look us up, just search for Pillars of Wealth Creation, and we'd love to interact with you in that way. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Love having people listen. I appreciate it. I mean, that it's fun to see comments on, we get some comments on the YouTube and Facebook and stuff like that. It's just fun to see. It's fun to see that people are enjoying it. And I get people that reach out to me every once in a while. So it's a blast. And I appreciate everybody that listens and that shares. And So it's fun to get that interaction with people.
Yep.
Well, cool, John. I think that's it. So make it a Saturday, make every day a Saturday, man.
All right. You too.
Are you ready to start investing in real estate today but don't know where to start? Sometimes investing can seem way too complicated, but it actually couldn't be any easier than with homeinvest.com. You know the co-founder and my friend Nate Armstrong. He appeared on episode 20, and if you haven't heard it, go back and listen to it, episode number 20. Home Invest is a company that allows you to invest in turnkey real estate. Their goal is to build powerful investment tools that make real estate investing accessible to everyone. They have contractors and property managers available for you with the click of your mouse. While other real estate agents can only offer a property, Home Invest brings you a full turnkey package that allows you to diversify your investments, earn passive income, and start building equity and properties. Their simple, intuitive design allows newcomers and experienced investors alike to hit the ground running and to be able to choose the properties when they want and where they want. View easy-to-understand charts and data to allow you to buy in only a few clicks or just a simple phone call. With Home Invest, you'll be building your portfolio as quickly or as slowly as you would like. And right now, Home Invest is giving our listeners, Pillar of Wealth Creation listeners, a free course on how to finally win in real estate investing. So go to homeinvest.com/pillars. That's homeinvest.com/pillars to claim your free course today.